Chapter 36. The two remaining ones hastened to catch the last train out of Budmouth Regis, and when they got to Casterbridge drove back to Upper Longpuddle. Along this very road as we do now, remarked the parish clerk. To be sure, along this very road, said the curate. However, Stephen and Olive were not at their homes. Neither had entered the village since leaving it in the morning. Emily and James Hardcome went to their respective dwellings to snatch a hasty night's rest, and at daylight the next morning they drove again to Casterbridge and entered the Budmouth train, the line being just opened. Nothing had been heard of the couple there during this brief absence. In the course of a few hours, some young men testified to having seen such a man and woman rowing in a frail hired craft. The head of the boat kept straight to sea. They had sat looking in each other's faces, as if they were in a dream, with no consciousness of what they were doing or whither they were steering. It was not till late that day that more tidings reached James' ears. The boat had been found drifting bottom upward a long way from land. In the evening the sea rose somewhat, and a cry spread through the town that two bodies were cast ashore in Lulstead Bay, several miles to the eastward. They were brought to Budmouth, and inspection revealed them to be the missing pair. It was said that they had been found tightly locked in each other's arms, his lips upon hers, their features still wrapped in the same calm and dreamlike repose which had been observed in their demeanor as they had glided along. Neither James nor Emily questioned the original motives of the unfortunate man and woman in putting to sea. They were both above suspicion as to intention. Whatever their mutual feelings might have led them on to, underhand behavior was foreign to the nature of either. Conjecture pictured that they might have fallen into tender reverie while gazing each into a pair of eyes that had formerly flashed for him and her alone, and, unwilling to avow what their mutual sentiments were, they had continued thus, oblivious of time and space, till darkness suddenly overtook them far from land. But nothing was truly known. It had been their destiny to die thus. The two halves, intended by nature to make the perfect whole, had failed in that result during their lives, though in their death they were not divided. Their bodies were brought home and buried on one day. I remember that, on looking round the churchyard, while reading the service, I observed nearly all the parish at their funeral. It was so, sir, said the clerk. The remaining two, continued the curate, whose voice had grown husky while relating the lover's sad fate, were a more thoughtful and far-seeing, though less romantic, couple than the first. They were now mutually bereft of a companion, and found themselves by this accident in a position to fulfill their destiny according to nature's plan and their own original and calmly formed intention. James Hardcome took Emily to wife in the course of a year and a half, and the marriage proved in every respect a happy one. I solemnized the service, Hardcome having told me, when he came to give notice of the proposed wedding, the story of his first wife's loss almost word for word as I have told it to you. And are they living in Longpuddle still? Asked the newcomer. Oh no, sir, interposed the clerk. James has been dead these dozen years, and his missus about six or seven. They had no children. William Privet used to be their odd man till he died. William Privet. He dead too? Dear me. Said the other. All passed away. Yes, sir. William was much older than one. He'd ha been over 80 if he had lived till now. There was something very strange about William's death, very strange indeed. Sighed a melancholy man in the back of the van. It was the seedsman's father, who had hitherto kept silence. And what might that have been? Asked Mr. Lagland. The superstitious man's story, William, as you may know, was a curious, silent man. You could feel when he came near ye, And if he was in the house, or anywhere behind your back without your seeing him, there seemed to be something clammy in the air, as if a cellar door was opened close by your elbow. Well, one Sunday, at a time that William was in very good health to all appearance, the bell that was ringing for church went very heavy all of a sudden. The sexton, who told me odd, said he'd not known the bell go so heavy in his hand for years. It was just as if the gudgeons wanted oiling. That was on the Sunday, as I say. During the week after, it chanced that William's wife was staying up late one night to finish her ironing, she doing the washing for Mr. and Mrs. Hardcome. Her husband had finished his supper and gone to bed as usual some hour or two before. While she ironed, she heard him coming downstairs. He stopped to put on his boots at the stair foot, where he always left them, and then came on into the living room where she was ironing, passing through it towards the door, this being the only way from the staircase to the outside of the house. No word was said on either side, William not being a man given to much speaking, and his wife being occupied with her work. He went out, and closed the door behind him. As her husband had now, and then gone out in this way at night before when unwell, or unable to sleep for want of a pipe, she took no particular notice, and continued at her ironing. This she finished shortly after, and as he had not come and she waited a while for him, putting away the irons and things, and preparing the table for his breakfast in the morning. Still he did not return, but supposing him not far off, and wanting to get to bed herself, tired as she was, she left the door unbarred, and went to the stairs, after writing on the back of the door with chalk, "Mind and do the door," because he was a forgetful man. To her great surprise, and I might say alarm, on reaching the foot of the stairs his boots were standing there as they always stood when he had gone to rest. Going up to their chamber she found him in bed sleeping as sound as a rock. How he could have got back again without her seeing or hearing him was beyond her comprehension. It could only have been by passing behind her very quietly, while she was bumping with the iron. But this notion did not satisfy her. It was surely impossible that she should not have seen him come in through a room so small. She could not unravel the mystery, and felt very queer and uncomfortable about it. However, she would not disturb him to question him then, and went to bed herself. He rose and left for his work very early the next morning, before she was awake, and she waited his return to breakfast with much anxiety for an explanation, for thinking over the matter by daylight made it seem only the more startling. When he came into the meal he said, before she could put her question, "What's the meaning of them words chalked on the door?" She told him, and asked him about his going out the night before. William declared that he had never left the bedroom after entering it, having in fact undressed, lain down, and fallen asleep directly, never once waking till the clock struck 5, and he rose up to go to his labor. Betty Privet was as certain in her own mind that he did go out as she was of her own existence, and was little less certain that he did not return. She felt too disturbed to argue with him, and let the subject drop, as though she must have been mistaken. When she was walking down Longpuddle Street later in the day she met Jim Weedle's daughter Nancy, and said, "Well, Nancy, you do look sleepy today." "Yes, Mrs. Privet," says Nancy. "I don't tell anybody, but I don't mind letting you know what the reason odd is. Last night, being old Midsummer Eve, some of us went to church porch, and didn't get home till near 1. "Did he?" says Mrs. Privet. "LD Midsummer yesterday, was it? Faith, I didn't think where 'twas Midsummer or Michaelmas. I'd too much work to do." "Yes. And we were frightened enough, I can tell ye, by what we saw." "What did he see?" "Apostrophe, you may not remember, sir, having gone off to foreign parts so young, that on Midsummer night it is believed hereabout, that the faint shapes of all the folk in the parish who are going to be at death's door within the year can be seen entering the church. Those who get over their illness come out again after a while, those that are doomed to die do not return." "What did you see?" asked William's wife. Well, says Nancy, backwardly, he needn't tell what we saw, or who we saw. You saw my husband, says Betty Privet, in a quiet way. Well, since you put it so, says Nancy, hanging fire, we thought we did see him, but it was darkish, and we was frightened, and of course it might not have been he. Nancy, you needn't mind letting it out, though 'tis kept back in kindness. And he didn't come out of church again. I know it as well as you. Nancy did not answer yes or no to that, and no more was said. But 3 days after, William Privet was mowing with John Chiles in Mr. Hardcome's meadow, and in the heat of the day they sat down to eat their bit o' nunch under a tree, and empty their flagon. Afterwards both of them fell asleep as they sat. John Chiles was the first to wake, and as he looked towards his fellow mower he saw one of those great white miller's souls as we call them, that is to say, a miller moth, come from William's open mouth while he slept, and fly straight away. John thought it odd enough, as William had worked in a mill for several years, when he was a boy. He then looked at the sun, and found by the place out, that they had slept a long while, and as William did not wake, John called to him, and said it was high time to begin work again. He took no notice, and then John went up and shook him, and found he was dead. Now on that very day old Philip Hookhorn was down at Long Puddle Spring dipping up a pitcher of water, and as he turned away, who should he see coming down to the spring on the other side but William, looking very pale and odd. This surprised Philip Hookhorn very much, for years before that time William's little son, his only child, had been drowned in that spring while at play there, and this had so preyed upon William's mind, that he'd never been seen near the spring afterwards, and had been known to go half a mile out of his way to avoid the place. On inquiry, it was found that William in body could not have stood by the spring, being in the mead 2 miles off. And it also came out that the time at which he was seen at the spring was the very time when he died. A rather melancholy story, observed the emigrant, after a minute's silence. Yes, yes. Well, we must take ups and downs together, said the seedsman's father. You don't know, Mr. Lagland, I suppose, what a rum start that was between Andrew Satchel and Jane Vollins, and the passon and clerk o' Scrimpton? Said the master thatcher, a man with a spark of subdued liveliness in his eye, who had hitherto kept his attention mainly upon small objects a long way ahead, as he sat in front of the van with his feet outside. Theirs was a queerer experience of a passon and clerk than some folks get, and may cheer ye up a little after this dampness that's been flung over yer soul. The returned one replied, that he knew nothing of the history, and should be happy to hear it, quite recollecting the personality of the man Satchel. Ah no, this Andrew Satchel is the son of the Satchel that you knew. This one has not been married more than 2 or 3 years, and 'twas at the time o' the wedding that the accident happened, that I could tell ye of, or anybody else here, for that matter. No, you must tell it, neighbor, if anybody, said several, a request in which Mr. Lagland joined, adding that the Satchel family was one he had known well before leaving home. I'll just mention, as you be a stranger, whispered the carrier to Lagland, that Christopher's stories will bear pruning. The emigrant nodded. Well, I can soon tell it, said the master thatcher, schooling himself to a tone of actuality. Though as it has more to do with the passon and clerk than with Andrew himself, it ought to be told by a better churchman than I, Andrew Satchel and the parson, and clerk. It all arose, you must know, from Andrew being fond of a drop of drink at that time, though he's a sober enough man now by all account, so much the better for him. Jane, his bride, you see, was somewhat older than Andrew. How much older I don't pretend to say. She was not one of our parish, and the register alone may be able to tell that. But, at any rate, her being a little ahead of her young man in mortal years, coupled with other bodily circumstances, apostrophe, ah, poor thing, apostrophe, apostrophe, cite the women, apostrophe, made her very anxious to get the thing done before he changed his mind, and 'twas with a joyful countenance, they say, that she, with Andrew and his brother and sister-in-law, marched off to church one November morning, as soon as 'twas day amiced, to be made one with Andrew for the rest of her life. He had left our place long before 'twas light, and the folks that were up all waved their lanterns at him, and flung up their hats as he went. The church of her parish was a mile and more from the houses, and, as it was a wonderful fine day for the time of year, the plan was that, as soon as they were married, they would make out a holiday by driving straight off to Port Bredy, to see the ships and the sea and the soldiers, instead of coming back to a meal at the house of the distant relation she lived by, and moping about there all the afternoon. Well, some folks noticed that Andrew walked with rather wambling steps to church that morning. The true thought was that his nearest neighbor's child had been christened the day before, and Andrew, having stood godfather, had stayed all night keeping up the christening, for he had said to himself, not if I live to be 1,000 shall I again be made a godfather one day, and a husband the next, and perhaps a father the next, and therefore I'll make the most of the blessing. So that when he started from home in the morning, he had not been in bed at all. The result was, as I say, that when he and his bride too he walked up the church to get married, the parson, who was a very strict man inside the church, whatever he was outside, looked hard at Andrew, and said, very sharp, how's this, my man? You are in liquor. And so early too. I'm ashamed of you. Well, that's true, sir, says Andrew. But I can walk straight enough for practical purposes. I can walk a chalk line, he says, meaning no offense, as well as some other folk. And, getting hotter, reckon that if you, passin' Billy Toogood, had kept up a christening all night so thoroughly as I have done, you wouldn't be. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.